It is 93.3 WMMR. I'm Pierre Robert, and we have the pleasure of the company of Mike Shinoda. The latest album of his is Post Traumatic on the Machine Shop label on Warner Brothers, and it came out on June 15th. And it is a great pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks, man. You too.
I want to take you back to a Philly moment before we go further. There was a time Linkin Park was playing at the Spectrum, the old Spectrum now long gone, and across the parking lot in the new arena, Elton John and Billy Joel were playing their Piano Man show, and someone in your camp wanted to meet them, and somehow it happened. Do you have memories of that day?
Of course. I mean, well, we had found out they were playing in town, and we were like, can we go see the show? Huh. You know, and they said, unfortunately, you know, it's the same night as your show, so it's not going to happen. And then, you know, I remember I really wanted to see them in particular. I grew up with their music kind of in the house. I think it was my mom more than my dad was into both artists. And then Jim Digby, who I think you know, our production manager, said...
he's from Philly.
Yeah, yeah. And he said, you know, I think we can work out a way to get you over to their show and watch a little bit and then get you back in time for your show. So I said, that's great. Yeah, let's do that. And as it turns out, we got to meet both of the guys, and they were so friendly and so spectacular. But I would say that Elton in particular, you know, he spent a ton of time with us.
The whole band?
Yeah, yeah. Like, wow. Some of our wives were out.
Wow.
Spent all his time with us and, like, even followed up afterwards. Like, the next week we got a letter, a signed letter from him saying how much he was, you know, loved to meet the band and how much he liked our music and stuff, which I thought was, like, so unnecessarily cool. Wow.
Did you get to watch any of the show or just...
I did. It was
how
great.
Did they get you across the parking lot? Because that's going to be packed. It's sold out house for Elton, sold out house for Linkin Park.
I have no idea.
There's no secret tunnel.
There is
the
not.
Places.
No.
So you've got this label of your own, Machine Shop label, and I think you and Brad put it together around 2004. Now, it's part of Warner Brothers, so you already have the presence of a large record company. Why did you want your own record company? What value was that for you?
These days, it's just a name. Back when we started it, we originally intended it to be a full blown, you know, what they call it, an imprint label, meaning the albums would get, you know, basically sent through the distribution of channels of Warner. And I put out my original kind of project outside of Linkin Park, Fort Minor. I put out Fort Minor on Machine Shop around the time when we set it up. And we signed a few artists, and it was really difficult to do that. I think that back then we had expectations of other artists that were unrealistic, and we didn't know how to talk to them. And it also just having a label, like, put us in a position where we were all of a sudden, like, the bad guy in a certain way. Like, they wanted to, you know, just be artists, and we wanted them to just be artists, but they saw us as being a label. So we stopped doing it. I didn't like the vibe of doing that. And I always like to have really, like, great, you know, relationships with other artists. And those ended up being a little contentious. So, these days, you know, Machine Shop is just, you know, name on there for the sake of kind of the history of it and to put our own records out.
On another topic, going back to your early days, is it true your mom encouraged you to get classical piano lessons at the age of 6?
I think earlier,
really?
Actually. I think
what
earlier.
Did she see in you that told
no,
her
it was
this
more,
kid's got to do music?
It wasn't about that. It was about having that other language, like, in your world and in the way that I, you know, I think that I probably was always very artistic, first of all. Like, she knew that I loved to draw since I was really, really little, and it translated pretty well. And then something about, like, you know, starting a thing and sticking with it and knowing that my brother and I did really enjoy it. I have a younger brother, and he's more adept with, like, classical. He's got more dexterity playing than I do. But I stopped. I basically did a little over 10 years of classical piano training and theory, and then moved straight to, like, basically the beginnings of what would end up being production, like making tracks and learning how to record them, and then eventually really writing songs.
And you were into guitar and other forms of production in high school. You get out of high school and you've got a band going. Was that a Zero? Was that
yeah,
Zero?
It was X-E-R-O. Yeah.
I didn't know how you pronounced
yeah,
it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, so you have an option of diving full time into music or going to the school for graphic design, and you go to college. And I'm curious if you did that as a you know, something to fall back on, or were your interests so varied that you that the graphic arts portion was important that you not let that go?
Oh, music
as opposed
was not,
to diving into music?
Yeah, music was not my main focus.
It was not?
It was not at that time. Like, I always thought I was going to be a painter, an illustrator, a graphic designer. At that time, you couldn't really do graphic design work in your laptop. So it was like I was learning about those things in school. I thought I would want to do album. I loved music, but I thought I would do album covers and album packaging and maybe even get into posters for movies and books and things like that. And it, and the music was always on the weekends because it was just, you know, we'd do it for fun. We'd have, you know, we'd do shows just locally. All of us lived around L.A., And basically, like, at a certain point, the music just got serious when other people started, you know, letting us know that, that there was an audience for it. Like, we wouldn't, I think skipping a bunch of steps, but once Chester was in the band, like, he had always dedicated, like, his whole life to it. Like, he always wanted to be a singer in a band. I always had a lot of things going on and had a lot of different interests. And so for me, it was like, well, if the music thing doesn't work out, like, we'll give it a good shot because it's basically so unlikely that it'll work. But if it does work, it's like a lottery, to winning lottery ticket. Like, it's like, what a special thing that that would be, that we're already at a point. And, you know, at a certain point we said, how lucky are we that we get to make an album and record it? How lucky are we that we get to go on a tour? Like, it's, of course you'd give up everything to go do that.
Do you remember the first time you met Chester?
Yeah, we met through a friend. We had actually a guy who was doing legal stuff for our band, an attorney for our band. He had another friend who was doing a lot of work, who was an attorney and doing a lot of work in Arizona. And when we were looking for a singer, like, a good friend of mine had sung for the band for a while.
Was that Mark?
Mark Wakefield, yeah. And Mark ended up, it wasn't a good fit for him. Like, he wasn't a good, it made him crazy. Like, he'd get, like, an ulcer from, like, going on stage. Like, it sucked. So he, and Mark actually ended up going into management, which is an awesome fit for him because he loves music and he's really good at, you know, he's a good sense of that type of thing. So we were looking for a singer, and we heard from this guy that there's this kid named Chester who was really, he's an incredible vocalist, but he was in between bands and couldn't seem to land on a thing that he was the fit for him. And if he didn't, like, it was almost like if he didn't find the right, he's good on his own, but he needed to find the right combination. We sent him our stuff, with four songs with vocals and then four songs without vocals. And he skipped his birthday party. He walked out on his own birthday party to go record them and sent them to us, like, the next day.
And that's where it began.
Yeah.
Was it instant fit?
I think so. I mean, like, we're very thorough when it comes to, like, thinking out, like, we know when something is an important decision to make. And so all six of us have always been pretty thorough when it comes to, like, vetting a decision like that. So we did, like, go through with go through the motions of, like, trying out other singers just so we could say, like, yeah, we tried, like, you know, 10 people out and Chester was the best one. Mm-hmm. But truthfully, like, the minute he sang, you obviously went, like, that's the best guy. Like, wow. He could have been the first guy and I would have thought, yeah, it'll be funny to see. It'll be funny to see how other people stack up next to this, like, Hercules of a singer, you know?
Do you remember the last time you saw him?
When we finished up a tour, yeah, we were in Europe.
You were on the One More Light tour.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Because it was about to come to Philly. It was
there was one other thing. Like, we did, he and I, I'm sorry, we actually went, sat in the studio for a little bit, just screwing around. We had a meeting, and then we screwed around in the studio a little bit. And he had told me how much he was looking forward to the next tour. And he actually, like, you know, we were playing around with some demos and things like that. It was a very casual kind of thing.
So the album is so potent, and so there are no lyric sheets on it, which is interesting. But you don't need them, because if you listen to it, everything is so clear. And at the very beginning of Post-Traumatic, it starts with Place to Start, which goes into Over Again. And I was floored the first time I listened to it, hearing the voices of people who I assume are your friends who had left these voices checking in on you after this horrible thing had happened to see how you were doing. And you put a few of those voices at the beginning of this record.
Right. What I really wanted to do is, it occurred to me at one point that because so much music, so many albums and so much music these days is like a product, right? Like a lot of people think of, when you think of music, you think of people putting out a product and people like coming up with a marketing plan and an aesthetic and all that stuff. Maybe more so in different genres. Like I think you see that more in pop and hip hop than you do in rock, but,
and Kiss,
but well, there's lots of varieties of it too, because, you know, because the boundaries between genres have blended so much. But the bottom line is that it occurred to me that as I was making this music, that if I was going to put it out in the world, I needed to find a lot of ways to make people feel like, to really put them in my shoes, to make them feel where I was coming from, because the album is essentially a diary of the first like 9 months after Chester passed away. So, you know, there were moments like this one moment in the beginning of the whole thing, I thought, well, what's, you know, I was getting these messages and I wanted people to hear those, to really see what it was like to get those kinds of voicemails from people. And then when I did the video for it, I shot it just on the selfie side of my phone. I shot this one take video and I paired it with that. And then at the end of it, I put images from my house of mostly of my kids' rooms. So you got that sense of like, this is a human being with a family. The family has been affected by this tragedy. And even the last, I believe it's the last shot in it, is my son's drawer next to his bed. And it's got fidget spinners in there and toys in there and the all access pass from the Hollywood Bowl show with, wow, Chester's picture on it. And that's what was in, still is, I think, in the drawer next to his bed.
And in the song Over Again, you referenced the Hollywood Bowl show, which was put on last October, which I came out for. And I had all these airplane problems and traffic problems. And by the time I got to the Bowl, you were in the last song.
Oh, wow.
I was crushed. I could hear a little bit of it from the parking lot, but I was so crushed because I love the band so much. And I, as soon as I heard about the show, but back to you reference your angst, you know, as you're getting ready for that show, because the band is rehearsed, you guys know what you're going to do. And yet, maybe you're not ready in a certain way. Maybe the audience is not ready.
What I did, I mean, as I was recording this stuff, I really just tried to say whatever was actually on my mind. Like, I think we all kind of edit out. So, you know, it's this, the typical version of it that we experience like all the time is somebody says, how are you doing? And you just automatically say, I'm doing fine. I'm doing great. Good. How are you? You know, it's like, if you actually take a beat and answer the question honestly, then it's more complicated than that. And so with this record, I tried to do the latter. I tried to really get into it and say, okay, well, here's what's actually going on in my head. And as it went along, like, you notice, you know, it's 16 tracks, which is a ton of music, especially for me to put out in this, to create in this amount of time. And by the halfway point, I'm really starting to think like, okay, I'm in a situation that I wouldn't have wanted to be in, that none of us would want to be in.
What do I do about it now?
I'm conscious of the fact that I've got friends who are experiencing it too, and fans who are having different versions of their experience with it. But if I just look at like, what do I want to do? What's like the healthiest thing for me to do? Then where does it go? Like, it's not, some people will, I don't know, it's almost like saying like making lemonade out of lemons, but it's, in a sense, it's not taking the situation, making it into a good situation, because it's not good. It's saying, okay, you've been dealt a hand of cards. You have to play them. So I'm clearly not a give up kind of person. I'm just going to take this and say, okay, where do I go? That's good for me, good for other people. And to some degree, like either inspiring or healthy or makes me happy to do.
A friend of mine, when his dad died, said to me, this is like, and I grew up in California, so I'm familiar with earthquakes. He said, it's like an earthquake. I said, what do you mean? He goes, there's that initial shock. And then you think you've got it, but your body and psyche and spirit really couldn't absorb that whole wave. So it protects you. And then when you're ready, you get an aftershock and you realize what this loss means on another level. Then you go for a while, you think you've got it, but you still haven't gotten it. And there's another aftershock. And when you sometimes least expect them, something will come in and you get the loss on another level. And it's almost only till all of those aftershocks have subsided, however long that takes, that one comes to peace with it. It made a lot of sense to me with people that I've lost. I don't know if it does to you, but I would ask you where you're at in your process at this very moment right now.
Well, I would say that, you know, listening to the album, first of all, there's a journey there. So it starts in a really dark place, and then hope starts to arrive. Like, I start to realize, okay, I'm still here. So what am I going to do about it? And by the end of the album, I'm having fun with stuff. I'm making songs that are about other things and moving on. And the album was basically completed in about 9 months. So if you think now it's been not quite a year and a half, but we're starting to get closer. There's all these other months of time since that album's been done. And I've been out here, you know, I've gone out on the road. The first shows I did completely by myself so that I could really shock my system and see, what kind of performer are you? What do you need to do on stage? What do you need that you don't have on stage?
Was that scary, by the way?
Super scary. Yeah. And exposed.
Yeah.
I learned different little subtle things about how to put my show together and what kind of performer I am and what kind of performer I want to be. And so I started evolving the set. I started doing tons of, like, I did all these different meet and greets with the fans. I've done interviews where I let people kind of run around and, like, control it and ask me all the questions. And at a certain point I got, like, realized that they don't know my fans the way I do. And I realized that there's a little bit of guidance that has to happen at a certain point. So the between me and, like, the fans of the project, I think things have gotten really, there's this wonderful balance happening right now in the show and in life in general, for me at least. I should say not at least, but, like, in a bigger way, where there's this nice balance of celebration for the history that we had and that we were allowed to have with Chester and with the band, and all, you know, not saying anything about any prediction about what could happen with Linkin Park, because none of us know. I am thoroughly enjoying these shows that I'm doing. The fans have been incredible. These shows enable me to do, like, deeper cuts and B-sides and songs that I wouldn't have gotten to play with Linkin Park that are so fun to play, and these fans love them. They're like, night after night, it's like I get requests for all kinds of stuff.
And you change your set list up.
Yeah, yeah. It's too, a different, right? Kind of set. Yeah. Like, the Linkin Park has always been a very, like, right, you know, write the set and play the set, you know, as good as you can,
right,
every single night. And this set is the other kind of set where it's like, I wrote the set list just a couple hours ago, and I'll probably change it before I walked in here, I made a change.
I can't see it tonight here in New York, but I'll be in Philly tomorrow. Please play Iridescent. I'm sorry I asked that.
It's Philly. I'm just to let any fan who's saying to themselves, oh, well, I might have to work, or I might have to go to this other thing, or I might not be able to get over there. The Philly show is going to be so good. I'm telling you right now.
Cool.
It's going to be so good. Do not, if you are even like a halfway fan, get your ass over to the venue. It's going to be so
there are
good.
Very few tickets remaining, by the way, but it's at the Fillmore, and it's going to be incredible. The healing process is fascinating because it works in all these different ways. And I read a story of the fans in China. You had left the venue right after the show, and you got 15 minutes down the road, and you got a call from your production manager. Can you tell us about that?
He said, the fans, about a third of the house is still here, and they're singing your songs. And I said, oh no, like, do they think I'm going to do another encore? Like, I've already obviously left. Like, why are they singing? He's like, no, they're just singing. They just want to stay. They just want to be together and sing. And I said, oh, that's okay. Like, I didn't think of that. What are you going to do? And he said, well, we're just going to let them. Is it okay if we just let them sing for, and they'll, you know, we'll keep you updated. I said, yeah, just don't disturb them. Let them do their thing. So he was asking, like, should we try and get them out? Like, should we ask them to leave? And so I said, no, don't ask them to leave. Just let them do their thing. So 15 minutes later, which is now 30 minutes, he texted and he said, yeah, they're still here. And then 15 minutes after that, he said, okay, now this is getting to be ridiculous. Like, the equipment is gone. The equipment is in the trucks. The roadies are ready to leave. Everybody has to go. We have to go set up, you know, leave and go set up the next show. And so is it okay with you if we ask them, like, let them know, you know, what should I tell them? And we basically ended up telling them, you know, thank you so much. We appreciate it. And your love has been received. And you can continue to, you know, sing as you leave. But these, all of the wonderful people that put this show together, have to go home to their families, go to sleep or go to work tomorrow. And so they left. But they told me that people were in their cars, on trains, like singing on the way home.
Wow.
Yeah.
Talk about healing. There was a tour that I saw with Chris Cornell and you guys, and it was a beautiful thing because during Chris's set, he opened the show. Chester would come out and sing Hunger Strike, and then during the Linkin Park set, Chris would come out. I can't now remember the song he sang with you guys.
I think it was Crawling.
Yes,
I think we did Crawling.
And he and Chester would duet on that, and I remember it, but I've also seen video of it online where each guy calls out the other name. Chester goes, Chris Cornell. Chris goes, Chester Bennington. Mm. And you get goosebumps, and there's so many bizarre ironies. I'm sure that you've noticed them more than most, but you know, the fact that Chester was singing at Chris's funeral, and then 3 months later, I don't know that it was planned, but on his birthday, this horrible thing happens in the exact same way. Do those thoughts cross your mind, or have you let those go at this point?
Well, you know, lately I've been getting questions. I'm not changing the subject on you, but there's actually a point to this, but a friend of mine just created a new show. It's on ABC. It's called A Million Little Things. And A Million Little Things follows a story of a bunch of guys who are friends, basically brought together by one guy who's all of their mutual friends. And he's like the most successful and the happiest and whatever. And he dies by suicide in the first episode. And so everybody's scratching their heads, asking themselves, like, he wasn't the one. Like, what the hell? You know, like, in fact, there's in the beginning of the show, like, one of the other guys has a handful of pills. And the thing that makes him not do it is that he finds out that the other guy is dead. So what goes through your head as you're watching it is, as you start, you know, the episodes are now starting to air and everything. For most of us, for most people that live through these things, and it doesn't have to be, you know, suicide. It could be just someone else's passing, but you don't get answers. Like, the answers, you know, for a lot of these things, sometimes the answers just aren't out there for you. And other times the information's conflicting. So you hear side A and then you hear side B, and what are you going to do? Choose a side? Like, I feel like that's not my job.
There's that song from U2, Stuck in a Moment, that Bono wrote about Michael Hutchence, about, you know, and it's always that there's that mystery to what happens in someone's head when they go to do that, because there were not signs in either guy. Mm. There's a video of Chester playing piano and singing with his kids a few days earlier. That's what confuses me, the mystery of it.
Yeah, there's no, I mean, you know, you're not going to, I don't think anyone will get anywhere with any of that. And even if they do, so what?
Right.
Like, that's the point, is so what? Like, I look at it like this, and I tell young people this online all the time about their online existence, but like they're in a much bigger picture. One of your greatest assets, one of your greatest currencies in life right now is your attention. Your attention is so valuable. Where are you spending that currency? Are you spending it on things that you love? Are you spending it complaining about things you hate? Are you spending it to change those things? You're just complaining. Are you spending it on things that are paid for by a corporation who's serving ad garbage on Twitter, and you're engaging in the ad garbage, and so thereby you're giving them your currency. You're spending your attention on something that doesn't deserve it. In all of these things, like, I'm trying my best, and this is not a perfect, we're all human and we're going to do things that we don't want to do. But at the end of the day, am I really spending my time and energy on things that I feel like are positive things that are actually going to get us somewhere? Or when I look back at it, I go, I'm glad I did that. These shows, for example, are they're some of the most inspired and inspiring shows for me that I've done. And I love being a part of it. I love seeing the fans. I spend a ton of time with the fans, usually if I have enough time during the day to do it. and I'm enjoying getting up on stage and doing it.
Just two more things about two more songs that are so powerful to me and always have been. What I've Done is one of them, because we all have monsters. We all have our own demons. And I'm convinced that the happiest people in this life are the ones that take theirs out and examine them in the light of day and go, all right, here's my shit, and deal with it. And those who can't, medicate it and stuff it down. And in that song, you know, in our travels, we make a lot of mistakes. And in that beautiful song, you know, the singer acknowledges the mistakes and the hurt, but then says, today this stops. You know, I just love that. And I forgive myself.
Right. I think that there was a duel when we wrote that. I think I pretty much, I don't remember if Chester wrote any lyrics on that song. People forget sometimes that like a lot of the stuff that he sang that I wrote, the process would be either I wrote it and showed it to him or we wrote it kind of together, but usually I'd come in with stuff first. And on a lot of songs, I'd write it and show it to him and he'd read it over and then sing it to the track. And he'd just go, yeah, that's great. And he wouldn't change a thing. And that was like, it was, you know, we joked that it was like the, to bring it back, like the Bernie Taupin, Elton John relationship. Like Bernie would write words and he wouldn't even write them to music. He'd just write the words and give them to Elton, and Elton would make them into a melody. The difference here, of course, is that like I wrote the melody, but Chester had a way of singing it that was more than anyone else I knew could sing. So he always added something special to it when he sang it. And in those cases with a song like that, like I know there was a duality between, like many of our songs, there's multiple layers of meaning to the song. Some of them had to do with socio-political things. You know, if you ever saw the video for What I've Done, you see images of the environment getting, you know, destroyed and of political things as well. But of course there was a very personal level of, you know, we all have demons. We've all made mistakes. And sometimes you've got to look at it and say like, I'm going to force myself to come to terms with this and do my best to move on.
And Iridescent, somewhat similar in that, you know, for those of you lost in desperation, it's okay and let it go. And it's such a beautiful melody. I'm crazy about that song.
It's like a fan favorite, you know, because of that let it go bit. I think the let it go part is really, it was one of the first songs where we were sending a message that was unmistakably positive, that it wasn't, you know, a lot of the stuff was very like people used to kind of make jokes at our expense that it was very angsty and negative. Sorry, that's what I grew up on. And that's what we, you know, we experienced a lot of this stuff, but, yeah, that was one of those songs. It was the first time for us to just be like, no, this, we're going to write some parts of this record have to be a positive message.
Last thing, I just am floored by who you are.
Come on.
No, but I'm not trying to be a fanboy or blow up your skirt. But what I mean by that is, to me, it's like, how can we access our higher selves? How can we operate on higher and higher levels of consciousness? And in that process, touch a lot of things and get a lot of things done. And it's not just music with you. It's art and it's producing and it's writing and it's touching all these different worlds and your charitable work and your foundation. It's inspiring to me. And you may be asked it before, but what is it that drives you, that gives you the energy to dive into all these arenas?
I mean, the energy part is built in. So that, I mean, I got a lot of questions from people that have worked for or worked closely with the band, and they see the amount of, like, I have to throttle myself. I have to like pull back on certain things and focus on, and refocus, because unedited, I'll just dive headfirst into every little idea that I have, I don't have time for. Like, it ends up being confusing, and I take on too many things. But the more important, I think, the thing is, like, there's simple things. Like, I don't watch a lot of TV. I don't even, the TV's almost never on in the house. I do listen to a lot of music. I do pay attention to the news, unfortunately. And so for me, as I'm doing those things, again, I'm looking for what's the place where my attention is best spent, that at the end of the day, I look back at it and I go like, good job. That was really, those were the things to be engaged in. Like there, you've heard the joke, the like old saying, like wise men don't argue with fools because from a distance people can't tell who is who. Right? It's like that. It's like,
I've never heard that actually.
Okay, so if you take that and apply it then to like Twitter
and your currency.
Right. So apply it to things you do on a daily basis. You open your phone. How many times do you open your phone? Why are you opening your phone? What are you engaging with? On Twitter, what are you engaging with? What are you looking at? Do you need to follow all those things? Are you responding to stuff? Are you retweeting stuff? Why? Just asking yourself why more often. It doesn't have to be some like crazy, you know, I'm not sitting on a mountaintop doing yoga. This is all just very real, practical stuff. And I don't want to be engaged with like...
So you don't get distracted.
I don't feel good. I feel worse in a day if I've been sitting there mulling, like mucking around in super crazy negative garbage.
There's a song called Brooding on the album, which is instrumental. And that may apply to that. I don't know.
I think that there's... especially when I've gone through really... You know, this past year plus has been, I've had some really hard looks at myself, my surroundings, you know. It's and some of the things are, you know, it's not a, if you have to pay rent and that's just, and it takes up a lot of your life and your time and, you know, don't feel bad about that. That's a thing you have to do, right? If you've got a family, you have to do, but start looking at the next step, the step beyond that. I follow a podcast called The Business of Hype. It's with a friend of mine named Jeff Staple, and he did one with a gentleman named Yassin, whose last name is escaping me, but he does. He's in a very high position at the sneaker brand Puma. If you ever heard this guy's story, he started from like nothing. And now he's like basically one of the most influential people in the sneaker industry. He literally got Rihanna to sign to Puma. He's gotten all these different celebrities to like come over to Puma, which was like a loser brand, like, you know, who knows how many tier down sneaker brand. And he did it. He didn't do it sheerly on will. He did it on inspiration and finding the things that are important to him. And then also strategy, saying like, well, I really want to be over there. I really want to have this kind of a job. So I'll take a smaller job. Like I don't have to have an ego about it. I'll do the hard work and work my way up to the thing that I actually want to do. And there's something to be said for that. I do that in incremental steps all the time.
Mike Shinoda, thank you so much for spending time with us on MMR. I really appreciate it. And good luck with the rest of the post-traumatic tour. It's good stuff.
I'm excited for the shows both tonight and in New York and in Philly. And I know for a fact that these are very, very, like, I've never had shows like these. There's something magical about them. And every night it's just, you know, it surprises me again, like what other version of the magic there is.
I can see it in your eyes. It's great. Man, yeah. Thank you so much.
Hey guys, it's Mike Shinoda, and I want to wish WMMR a happy 50th birthday. Hey, it's Mike Shinoda, and I want to wish WMMR a happy 50th anniversary. Hey, what's up? It's Mike Shinoda, and you're listening to Pierre Robert on WMMR. And he's the best guy of all time. And I love him. And he's got fabulous hair.